since I let us all off the hook last time, what I'm going to start out with is a survey of the things we covered last semester. And if you're really interested, I just got my schedule for next fall that I'll be covering again next fall. So you could do it backward if you're interested, if you like what you've had after this semester. I won't hold you to that. But I'll be doing 19th century Germany again in the fall. And I think it really is necessary for you to have some sense of it, because there are references back that we need to have in common. And so what I want to do is just give you a survey of the main themes that we covered there. Now, I won't take you through all the readings, because the people who were in that class would look at me and say, you're absolutely crazy, because there were a lot of pages. But what I did think I would do is to open with a music example and then talk over the visual examples as touch points and take you from late 18th century Germany up to the beginning of the 20th century. And then we'll take a break and we'll talk about Heinrich Mann specifically. But hopefully I will have set up things that will inform your reading of the Heinrich Mann, whether you have started it or whether you haven't. So let's start out first with a work of powerful significance in all of German history, but late 18th, early 19th century German history, and use it as a way to get us started. Should have checked that. Let me go to another course where I know that's why. Then we'll add the political layer. It's just a beautiful melody. As beautiful as anything anybody ever wrote. I mean, it is. I mean, it's as beautiful as anything Mozart ever wrote. Or Beethoven, or Bach. It's just a beautiful thing. And then here he puts it into a movement for a string quartet of theme and variation. So that's the theme presented very directly. And now, as an 18th century composer would, he's going to show you what he can do. He's going to show off. And he's going to draw from that theme everything that he can as a musician, maintaining the theme, but adding to it, adjusting it rhythmically, changing the instrumentation, playing it in different keys, speeding it up, slowing it down. Very pro forma mode of composition that was the classical style by the end of the 18th century, mastered by a kid named Mozart and his elder, who recognized him as an equal, Joseph Haydn. And this is Joseph Haydn. So let's just do a couple of his variations. Here it's just that that walking violin along with the main theme. Like a vine wrapping itself around the theme. Or, dare I say, a beautiful young woman wrapping itself around that theme. The theme's just sort of moving along there, and it's basic, just being enveloped in that beautiful line that the violin's providing. Let's do one more. Someday what I want to do is come in, smile, do all my tech stuff, and then just put on a piece of music and let it play for an hour and then walk out. It's all there. And just say, well, okay, now go figure it out. They wouldn't pay me if I did that. Let's see what the cultural historian might do with this. Okay, first of all, we'll think about it in the music world, okay? Not musicology, but, you know, a little music history. End of the 18th century, he might have done this a little bit later, early 20th century, but, or 19th century, but I'd have to look at the date. It's probably on the website I'm going to show you in a second. Haydn is a master of the classical tradition. His story is woven together with what we refer to as classicism in 18th century German culture, which I'm going to talk to you about in a minute. And that's because he and Mozart take the musical legacy coming from Bach and Handel and other Baroque artists from the early part of the century, and really they're living in the frivolous era of the Rococo. How many of you have seen Marie Antoinette? Okay, so you know that whole thing, right? And they're court entertainers for that world. And so they do a lot of fun, happy, silly stuff for dances and to keep those aristocrats happy and horny, and they do, right? But they're incorporating ideas in music and of their time, and the ideas of their time include this orientation toward rationalism and breaking out of the superstitions of the Baroque world and the frivolity of the Rococo and doing things practically and doing things in a constructive way and a productive way. Well, music is always, you know, can't be accused of being productive and practical, but still they develop forms, they develop structures that synthesize all of these elements that they're inheriting and that they're surrounded with. The Baroque forms, they incorporate the frivolity and the fun and the beauty and the elegance, and you might say the Italianate song-like aspects of the, we'll say, the Rococo. But then this notion that, well, we can balance this out with some sort of a structure, and we can take beauty and frame it in a way that's consistent with Enlightenment thinking, with the thought of the Enlightenment about practical things and organizing things and using reason to manage your affairs and to observe and understand the world. And what Mozart and Haydn do is frame these beautiful melodies and songs that they're producing in structures like the sonata form, which is the most famous of the forms that they devised, the two of them really, separately, but they knew what the other one was doing because Haydn was just worshipped what Mozart was doing, and Mozart worshipped Haydn as a senior example. And the sonata form in music comes to embody the Enlightenment agenda. It has a beginning, a middle, an end. And the beginning introduces a problem, which takes the form of two different sounding melodies or songs that seem to be inconsistent, that seem to clash. They're in different keys, and they have a completely different feel, often male and female in the less than modern era. Right, described as male and female. And then there's a period of development, this we'll call it the middle period section, in which they allow themselves to do whatever the hell they want. They provide themselves with complete freedom. And here's the dream, freedom. If we loosen things up a little bit and get away from these Baroque structures and authoritarian system of the old regime, the individual will be free to do what he or she wants. And in the development section, the composers did what they wanted. And they took those themes and they took them into different key areas, and they completely transformed them, like a theme and variations, but even to the point of not being able to recognizing. Or they might even bring in other themes and other material. I mean, it's an area for their fantasies to run free. But as you experience that, and especially the 18th century mind, but even ours to a certain extent, there becomes, you sort of get worried, like, where is this going? Is it ever going to end? Are we ever going to come home? Is it ever going to be rounded out? We're hungry for that sense of resolution. So they start playing with that psychological need, and even to a certain extent intellectual need, to close this out. So the development section starts to go back toward home, which is the key that it started in. And it's very emotional. You can feel it when you're aware of it. But if you're not aware of it, you still feel it. It's like reading a Jane Austen novel. You want them to get together. I mean, come on. You know, Darcy and Elizabeth. Please, would you please find each other so the movie can end? Well, that's the feeling that one has, right? It was a book first, but we'll talk about the movie, right? So they play with that. They start hinting, oh, we're going to go back, and then they'll pull it back, and they'll go, no, we're going to go back now. No, not we're going to go back. No, we're going to go back now. And just about when you're just about to give up, they go, here it is. And boom, you come back. And then they review the first part again. There's been some adjustments, but it comes back. And this resolution provides a lot of relief and a lot of satisfaction. So within this framework of the sonata form, right, they've shown really the Enlightenment agenda. If we could break away from the old pattern, right, and we can become free to do what we want. Right? But we're not going to go crazy forever. It's not going to be hedonistic, self-purpose flights of fancy forever. We are going to close the deal. We come back around, and the conclusion is one that's orderly, but it also indicates some sort of progress. Because actually, when they come back, the A and B, the two themes, aren't in conflict anymore. They're both in the same key. So it's just this beautiful resolution that indicates that through a process of change and development like this, we can actually move forward a little bit. Which is essentially what the Enlightenment thinkers are saying about everything. You know, if we give up our old superstitions and we really look at what nature does, well, we can understand how nature works, and maybe we can, you know, cure some diseases or farm better, right? And we'll move ahead in small pieces, and, you know, eventually we'll have iPods, and it'll be great, right? That's the agenda, but we have to take those steps forward. And so that's the intellectual, musical world that Haydn's part of, this 18th century world. Now, he also has a body. You know, he's a person. And, you know, that gets gummed up in music. Musicians, you know, and especially musicologists, just don't really want to think about that. But there's this person who gets up in the morning and has toothaches and needs to eat and needs to go to the bathroom and all of those things, and, you know, has to interact with the real world. And that's a fascinating part of the story, too. Haydn was not an aristocrat. He was not of any money at all. But he was born into this absolutist world and had to survive within it. And he started as a musician as a Vienna Boys Choir member. He was, you know, the Vienna Boys Choir. They come around every once in a while. Or if you go to Vienna, you go see them, and they're just beautiful. They sing these beautiful choral works, and it's beautiful to hear boys' voices singing that. And there was a real taste for this in the 18th century as well. And that's when the Vienna Boys Choir, which is associated with the cathedral in Vienna, began. And he was one of the singers. So was Schubert later, but I'll tell you about him at some point, maybe. But the problem with boys in boys' choirs is that they become men. And when they become men, their voices crack and their voices change. And therefore, they're not boy singers anymore, and they're not desirable as members of the boys' choir. And what they did was throw them out. See ya. That's it. Okay. And that's what happened to Haydn. He was out on the streets of Vienna, fighting to survive. And he was busking. You know, he was just a street entertainer. And some aristocrat looks and sees this little boy out there and has a case of noblesse oblige, the obligation of the nobility to help this little boy, and he does. He provides him with some, he gives him shelter, and he provides him with music lessons to continue. And that's how Haydn, you know, made it out of obscurity and worse off of the streets, and went on then to become a composer. But he was ever obligated to this system. He didn't break with it. He went on to become the court composer for a nobleman in the Austrian aristocracy, the Esterházy family. Okay, and he was a loyal, dedicated servant to that man for the most of his life, for the next 60 years, 50, we'll say 50. Never questioned it at all. Right? He would write music for this guy who had enough, you know, he was doing pretty well. Various palaces in Vienna and outside of Vienna, the Esterházy lands. And they would go back and forth, and he would have orchestras and operas and chamber music performing all the time. So it was a great gig. It was a great gig for Haydn. And he stuck with it. And worked for this guy as his servant, in the servant's quarters, eating at the servant's table, never questioning his place in society at all. The only time there's any sense of any indication that Haydn resisted at all was a point where, for whatever reason, the count was hanging out at the summer house outside of Vienna longer than usual. He wasn't moving the whole court back into Vienna. And all the musicians, their families were all in Vienna. You know, it was like a pro sports team or whatever. You know, they weren't around their families. They wanted to go back. But they had to wait till the count decided. So Haydn put together a piece. He had a sense of humor, a very funny one, actually, more so than Haydn and a lot more than Beethoven, although Beethoven's sense of humor is an acquired taste. But he wrote a piece where gradually, the whole orchestra starts out playing, but gradually each of the sections of the musicians get up and walk out, until Haydn was standing on the stage alone, right? And the count got the joke. He said, "Oh, you want to go back to Vienna? Okay, we'll go back to Vienna." Right, that was it. So that was their mode of revolution. And then he was given his papers when he was 70 years old or 60 years old after all these years of service. And he did have a career afterward for his, you know, basically as the grand musician of the old regime. But that was after the revolutionary period. But he, you know, he worked his contract to the end. So he's very much a part of that old regime. And the fact that it was, we could say, divided up into these little authoritarian monarchs, these little counts who had their domains, and they controlled their domains absolutely. And this is what Germany and Austrian lands were broken up into in the 18th century. There were just hundreds of these guys who had that kind of power over the individuals in their service. Right? They weren't slaves, that had been taken care of, but they were definitely part of this feudal system of fealty to those individual feudal lords. Okay. Now, this piece, by the way, I haven't even thrown this in. Do you know what that tune is? Does anyone recognize the tune? It's the German national anthem. Okay, good. I guess maybe if you didn't realize that, you'd wonder what the hell he's talking about. Haydn wrote a song in honor, not of his Count Esterhazy, but of the Austrian Emperor. Hail to the Emperor. Okay? And that's the tune that he wrote for that song. Da 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 da. That's the tune. Okay. So he wrote that song explicitly, there's no question about it, in order to honor the notion, I guess, of a larger political authority above and beyond the individual count and dukes and whatever the range is of smaller feudal lords. So he paid homage to the Kaiser in this way. Right? So that song was written first as a political statement. As a political statement. Now, I don't think there's much more to Haydn's politics, but obviously the notion of something bigger was in his mind. Right? And he was paying homage to it in that sense. Now, later on, that song's fate will change. That song follows the evolution of German history. And there's some description here on the site that I'll show you in a second. But it is first dedicated to the Austrian Kaiser. Then, in the beginning of the 19th century, as the Germans are starting to think about organizing themselves, and Austria is still part of the quotient, if that's going to work out that way, that's the large German option. If you're going to include everybody, Austria will be part of it, right? And that song is appropriated by the liberal proponents of unification, culminating in 1848, this effort at a liberalization of Europe and the development of a constitution which was very open and very progressive, as I told you about last time. And it was put to new words. It was put to new words and called not the Ode to the Kaiser anymore, but it was put to the German song, the Deutschlandlied. And here are the words of that.
Germany of Germany, above all. Now this bothers people right from the start, looking retrospectively, because it sounds like you're saying Germany above, you know, France, above England, above the United States, above Russia, because we see it through the lens of that take on. Above everything in the world, when always for protection we stand together as brothers. Okay. From the Maas, which is the Meuse in France and Belgium, to the Memel, which is a river that's way over here by Lithuania. Okay, that's the really dangerous one. Because East Prussia goes way over toward over what we think of as Poland now, right? And then there's Lithuania and Latvia and Russia. So saying that Germany goes to the Memel, it's like saying Wisconsin goes to Ann Arbor, right? Right over the top of Lake Michigan, you know, that's ours, over there, right? From the Etsch, which is way down in Tyrol. I don't know if you know about the Tyrolean Mountains. That's northern Italy and Austria. And there are, if you go down there, there's ethnic weirdness in the Tyrol, where, you know, there are towns that all the signs are in German and all the people speak Italian. You know, it's, you know, and they hate each other. Okay? So that still goes on down there. So there's in that, so from the Tyrol up to the Belt, which is a weird sort of river up in Denmark. Okay? So here, Germany, Germany, above all in the world, comprises of crosses a lot of borders. That's the big Germany. That's the total Germany. And it's not, you know, in 1848 then it's going to include Milwaukee and Chicago, by the way. Right? Because anybody who goes there because of an ethnic and cultural identification of what Germany is, anybody who goes to Milwaukee and Chicago, they'll always be welcome back if things turn out right for them politically. Right? So, I mean, that leads to this weirdness in Germany where someone who's born and raised in Milwaukee could walk into Germany and get complete citizenship instantly. That was it. That's it. And all rights and all privileges and everything. Whereas a Turkish kid who's grown up in Berlin his whole life doesn't. Right? So that's part of all of this. But when they're saying Germany, Germany above all, in 1848, right, what they're saying is all of us who are Germans within this range, we need to dedicate ourselves to the notion of a Germany. Right? Even if you live in when these little principalities, you live in Austria, I'll use big principalities because I don't know the names of the little ones, but you live in Austria, you live in Bavaria, you live in Prussia. Don't think about yourselves as Prussian, Bavarian, or Austrian. Think about yourselves as German, because we need to think about ourselves as unified. Okay. So that's what the first stanza, or in German, Strophe, right, signifies. Now, after the Second World War, no way. Illegal to sing that in Germany. I mean, you know, it's an open society, but there's some things they don't want. You can't have swastikas. You can't read Mein Kampf. You can't watch Triumph of the Will. And you can't sing the first stanza of the Deutschlandlied publicly. Right? You could be put in jail. That's censored. And actually, that's a residual of American policy. Anti-Nazi denazification policy. Okay, so but you can see why. Taken out of context, the Nazis emphasized this. One, they emphasized the first story. And they made it seem like, yeah, we're gonna take those lands. It's not an internal thing; it's an external thing. Okay. Now, German women, German loyalty, German wine, and German song. For some reason, the politicians don't play around enough with this one.
I don't know if it's sexist or anything. I haven't thought about it completely. But, you know, if I were a German, I would want to sing the second strophe. That would be fine. Wine, beer, women, men, let's have a party. Sounds good to me. Seems innocuous enough. But, no, they've gone to this one, the third. That's the one that's legal and is sung as the German national anthem. Unity and law and freedom for the German fatherland. Let us all strive for that in brotherhood with heart and hand. Unity and law and freedom are the foundation of happiness. Bloom in the glow of happiness. Bloom, German fatherland. Okay. Now the Nazis, they weren't so interested in that. They would have a little problem with these two. Right? So they de-emphasize that one and emphasize that one. And the new German Republic and probably the Weimar Republic sang this one, sings this one. So that melody is attached to all of this. Here's where that high cultural impulse connects with all of the, you know, specifics of German politics and German politics and culture intersect in a profound way, all the way through from Haydn's inspiration, which can make us forget how beautiful the tune is, especially in its original form or the way he presented it he wrote the song first and then he wrote the quartet that included a movement that included was based on the song. Sometimes I like to think it was in the quartet first because then it would have been pure music and then he took that tune and put it to the oath to the Kaiser, but it's the other way around actually. It was originally politically inspired. Now, here is the visual manifestation of the trend of classicism in 18th century Germany. And the reason it's very important to recognize this, I talked a little bit about it in the music, is to remember and remind ourselves that there was a tradition of enlightenment in German culture. And it was a strong one. It wasn't just France and England that had the Enlightenment. In the 18th century, there were German thinkers and German artists who also professed the centrality of reason, rationality, in all areas of life, in understanding man and in understanding what man should do in this world and in understanding what society and politics should be structured as. So all of the ideas that, by the way, are the ideas driving this experiment that is the United States of America, this political experiment that we're all part of. Right? So these should be familiar to you. Thomas Jefferson and the founding fathers' ideas, right, are those of the classical Enlightenment. And they were manifested in the 18th century visually, as well as in literature, with reference to the classics, with reference to Greece and Rome. They looked back at Greece and Rome and they said, those Greeks had a prototypical democracy. Now let's set aside the fact that it was a slave culture and all, you know, you had to be a man of a certain landholding level and women were not included and all of that. That doesn't cloud the idealized vision of what Greece had been. Athenian Greece approached democracy and had these great philosophers, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and so forth. And for a little while, you have this golden age in Athens, which sounds like it lasted for centuries. It actually only lasted for about 75 years. But still, the reality doesn't matter. There's this myth in Western culture of this Camelot that once existed in Athens. And progressive thinkers have always referred back to that as this is what man is capable of, and we're going to rebuild something like that in Athens, a new white city on the hill. And you don't have to look further than Washington, D.C. and Thomas Jefferson's designs to see in America how that manifested itself. We want to build buildings that look like Athens, and this is the new Athens. Well, they're doing this in France, and they're doing this in England, and they're doing it in Germany, right? Germans are not always marching around with torches and planning to invade other places. At this point, they're trying to get these ideas and communicate those. And great writers like Mendelssohn, Moses Mendelssohn, not the composer, for those of you who are into the music, but his grandfather, Moses Mendelssohn, writes a beautiful literature in general, but a beautiful play called Nathan the Wise. And in that play, he basically says, you know, all religions are the same. It's the same path to salvation, and we should. It's really the religion that represents the most tolerance and does the most for man in this sphere, that is the chosen one, that is the superior one. So let's wait 1,000 years and find out, but let's not fight among ourselves. Right? Judaism, Christianity, Muslims, we should coexist. So very, you know, beautiful Enlightenment vision. And another book that we read, or bit that we read last time, was A History of Ancient Art by a man named Winckelmann. Now, he'll show up in your readings, because he really is the one who said those Greeks are the ones who represented in architecture and in art this notion of the rationally balanced individual. The individual who is not overcome by his sentiments, by his feelings, by his passions, but remains calm. Right? There are deep waters, right, but the surface is calm, even under great tension, because reason is dominant. So he looks at all the great Greek sculptures and he says, this is what we have to shoot for. This is the visual model. Okay. And he contributes to this notion of using classical references in the visual arts to symbolize these ideas of it's a universalist view, but of what Germany or the Germanies that are around could be. And they're very consistent, these voices and these images, with what the French Enlightenment and the British Enlightenment and the American revolutionaries were presenting as that possibility. This was part of the German tradition, and it's one vision of what Germany could be. And it's literally going to take 200 years for that to be realized, but to a certain extent, the Berlin Republic that we are dealing with now is the Republic of the Enlightenment. It's finally accepted it without the other stuff. And so it's relevant. Right? But that tradition existed. That's one Germany that we can have. Now, this was counter. This was countered, even in the 18th century, by voices that said reason's has much to be excited about, right? But it's not everything. We have to be concerned about excessive emphasis on reason and rationalism as the only way to address existence and management of human life in this existence, and including politics. Because if we do that, we're going to create a one-dimensional man that is superficial and concentrating only on material things and coming up with logical, rational, boxy ways of doing things, and that's going to involve overlooking the passionate and emotional and sentimental side. So, you know, let's move along with reason. That's good. But let's do it in a way that does not over-emphasize that to the detriment of the other side of human nature. Okay? And these voices point out in stories and in images that things aren't always as simple as reason can construct or reason can manage. That we have dreams, we have nightmares, and these are symbolic of forces within us, subconscious forces, we might say, in a post-Freudian age, right, that can overtake us and can weaken that reason. So paintings of, you know, nightmares and paintings of awakening in Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, and all the weird figures and so on and so forth. This is actually a Swiss painter, but you know, if you take the broad German, the Grossdeutsch
interpretation. It really doesn't matter that he's from Switzerland, and he works for the most part in England, but that said, he's indicative of that emphasis on this spiritual, and his paintings aren't boxed off and linear and organized the way the classical artists were doing at the time. He's breaking away from that. It's much more sort of mysterious and bizarre and less framed. Okay? And the great work of German literature at this time, communicating this, is by this guy whom the bus drivers call Goethe. Okay? Some of them. It's pretty rare, actually, now, but I still hear it every once in a while. But Goethe. Goethe's a young man, and, you know, in his 20s, teens and 20s, and he's had some affairs. He's very tall and handsome. Very tall and handsome. And he has his way with women. There's no doubt about it. And he has some flings, but he's conscious. And he captures the emotions of those things in his poetry, and those profound emotions. And he also recognizes the tremendously powerful emotions that he triggered in women. And he left a couple behind, and he knew that he broke their hearts, and he shattered their peace. And he could see that in himself, as well as them, there were things that were going on that reason couldn't control. So he wrote a short novel called The Sorrows of Young Werther, The Sufferings of Young Werther, really Leiden des jungen Werthers. Beautiful, beautiful story of this kid who just rejects reason, rejects being just doing your job, and writing things correctly and being a lawyer and doing what you're supposed to do, right, for an emotional connection with life. And he just immerses himself down in the grass and stares at the beetles and the dirt and so on and so forth and tries to engage at that microscopic level. And he looks up at trees and he looks up at mountains, he looks up at clouds and stars, and he's just, oh, so emotionally connected with this totality. And but if that's not enough, he falls in love with a woman named Charlotte, who is engaged to get married. And that experience of a forbidden, impossible love drives him to suicide. And this novel, this short novel, follows his breakdown to the point of shooting himself. And just the extremes to which he attached himself to this woman that was unattainable. Beyond explanation, beyond logic. Not reason and the Enlightenment can't explain that. He literally throws himself into despair and death, driven by this need for a heightened emotional experience, sentimental experience. So Goethe writes this story and reminds people, you know, reason isn't going to take care of everything. Right? So there's this counter. And that counter becomes very popular among young people. As his book is published, people become obsessed with Werther. They start to dress like Werther, and they even start to kill themselves like Werther. Copycat suicides happen. And this scares the shit out of Goethe. I mean, he's freaked out. Man, that's not what I meant. You know, it was kind of satirical what he was doing. But they read it literally and engaged with it completely. And, you know, proved that he was right. You know, that you know, people are hungry for or capable of this tremendous level of passion to the point of self-destruction. So... Before the beginning of the 19th century, these things are on the table. Reason versus passion. Right? Enlightenment thinking versus passionate romantic thinking. This is before there's even a romantic movement. Okay. Now, and though both of those sides exist within German culture. Now, after 1789 and 90, things get more intense. up to this point, you know, who cares what's going on in some small German principalities where this little Goethe writer is writing and a few people kill themselves? It's not a big deal, right? Because Germany's divided. It's a non-entity. But big things are happening over in France. France breaks out in revolution. I'm going to restrain myself from giving you a full survey of the French Revolution, which would just reflect things a little bit. And is threatened by anti-revolutionary forces that do include German princes from these little principalities who want to keep the Pandora in her box, or the stuff in Pandora's box. They don't want it coming their way. So Polish and German and Austrian and Italian and Spanish and British forces all, you know, at various times try to cap this revolutionary impulse coming out of France. Now, there are people in Germany who are like, bring it on, yes, 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 reason, enlightenment, structure, you know, this is good. So it's not all Germans, because we've seen there were those enlightened classicists who like it. But of course, the princes are the first ones who resist it, and they mount their armies, their professional armies together, and they go on and out and try to take on these French armies. When they notice something, my paid German soldiers, as disciplined as they may be, don't tend to want to die in battle. How are we going to figure that out? Because these French guys are willing to die. They're willing to charge en masse with no training, right, and sacrifice themselves to la nation. This incredible elan, which is what the French call it, is coming at us. Holy moly! Right? What's that? These people are willing to sacrifice themselves because they're citizens of a nation that they have a stake in. And by the way, there's this young general down south who can really get them fired up. Right? And by the way, he's also really smart. He keeps putting his artillery places we didn't expect it to be. And he can get these people to march from here to there in 6 hours rather than the 2 weeks it would have taken us to get there. And then they come in and throw themselves into battle after a six-hour march. This is a whole different ballgame. So when they see Napoleon coming and then rise to power and organizing France according to these rational principles that satisfy the Enlightenment impulse, even among Germans, but at the same time getting this incredible, using this charisma and this excitement that the people have about sacrificing or about defending their nation, right? The Germans have to get it together. They look at that and say, we want that. That would be good. That would be good. And that, by the way, that's the only way we're going to be able to defend ourselves from this guy and from this nation that's been unleashed. Okay. So, although he's in charge, under the French occupation, there starts to bubble up this new way of, or not new, we know it's not new, but this way of thinking about Germanness. First of all, we need to push those French back. They're pretty unanimous in this. It was all right for Bonaparte to come in and do these things, but when he stays, he's kind of a burden, because his armies just take what they want to eat, and they start pushing everybody around, and the welcome gets worn after a while. We like the fact that he comes in with a lot of rational principles about state education, and thank you, after hundreds of years, taking our 300 and some principalities and reorganizing them in 30, which is a great benefit for us. We're glad that he does that, but generally we would like the French to get the hell out so we can take care of ourselves. Okay? That's pretty common among Germans, even if you did support the revolutionary principles and Napoleon at the beginning. Okay? So we need an army that's going to fight the way the Germans did, the way the French did. We need a culture that people are going to attach themselves to, the way the French are attaching themselves to their idea of the nation. Now, the French version is this mainline Enlightenment idea. Reason, progress, practical approach, new economy, things that will lead to capitalism and industrial revolution if the proto-communists don't get in the way, which they don't, right? So that's the French way. That's civilization. We're not going to do that exactly the same way. What we're going to do is tap into that romantic side, that this notion of German culture. And that's growing in the midst of this too. Because the young people who've been influenced by Goethe and are now living through the French Revolution are really articulating this emotional and spiritual approach to existence. And countering that in part against this French way. And they're saying, well, the individual in this new environment is going to be freer. That's good, to a point. But freed from all the structures that existed before, the patterns of society and the economy and religion and so on, right, is also threatens to render the individual very isolated and very alienated from others and from themselves. They just become, they're threatened with becoming cogs in the machine. Now think about all of you right now. You're on the cusp of going out there into the big world and figuring out what the hell you're going to do. And you don't know. I mean, it's hard. You're scared to death that you're going to end up homeless. All of you are. You're scared to death. My God, I'm going to end up homeless, or I'm going to have to live with my parents, and I don't know which is worse. Right? Because you're thrown out there alone now. And you have to fight for your existence in this free economy. You can be anything you want. Right? Or you can crash. And, you know, the sky's the limit, so there's that freedom. But you have the responsibility is on you alone to make those decisions. Well, that was very new to that generation. Right? And it was scary, just as scary as it is to you. So a lot of them start to say, well, this new order is exciting, but it does jeopardize the soul of the individual. So we want to, again, as the Sturm und Drang, as Goethe did before, we want to emphasize the soul and the spirit. Not just to remember that that's part of our being, right? But to provide us with a sense of belonging to something bigger. That we're not alone. We're not alienated. We're not isolated. We may be in a social and economic sense, but when we need to, we can think of ourselves as being part of a greater totality by contemplating on nature, by contemplating love, by contemplating religion. We can feel that we're part of some larger emotional whole. And that's what the Romantics are doing when they paint these, let's say, pictures of monks out in the woods. Right? The monk is alone, he's out in the woods, but he's connected to those through those flowers and through those trees to something much bigger. Or by painting cows, right? You know, cows are always around, that's eternal, right? Next to old 16th century castles or medieval castles and reinvoking the medieval. I'm part of something that goes back into the past. Or by going up to mountaintops and looking out over the scene from them. You go up to the mountain, and you look up at the sky, and you look out over the mountain, you see other mountains, and you just feel like you're part of this. And the only time we see this thing is on car commercials now, you know, where they tell you if you have this kind of car, you're going to be able to drive up the mountains. I just don't know what all the rangers are going to do when you drive off of the road and drive up to that peak. But there you go. They tell you that you're going to be able to do that, and you're going to have that moment of feeling that you belong to a larger universe, right? Well, that's what these images suggest. Caspar David Friedrich. Or, you can go over to the next mountain and look into the woods, and by contemplating those trees, those pines, the German pines, you literally will have the same experience that a pre-modern German would have had when he or she went into a Gothic cathedral. They're morph into one another. The spiritual aspect of nature is highlighted. So it's a religious experience to go out into nature, even a Christian one. So the individual can find some sort of connection, some sort of solace by doing that. And that cultural movement is happening at the same time that Germans are, German politicians and German military leaders are trying to find a way to inspire Germans to feel that they belong to a greater cause and be willing to sacrifice themselves for that greater cause. And actually, death is part of this, because the ultimate expression that I'm really not of this world and attached to it and constrained to it, and not just a materialistic cog in a materialistic world, is the willingness to let go into flights of fancy first, even madness second, and ultimately unto death. Remember, Werther committed suicide, and to step beyond that way is a way of saying, well, I'm stepping into something bigger. And that could be transferred over to feeling that you belong to a cause, the mission of the state, the mission of the German nation, the mission of the German culture. You belong to that. It's a big thing. Right? We've all been broken up. Let's feel united. Right? And then when we fight those French, right? Even if you die, you've just stepped beyond. And you made yourself part of this glorious tradition of those who are willing to sacrifice themselves for these ideas. Right? I mean, this is that romantic impulse that gets incorporated into military culture, and it's still incorporated into military culture. This is when you join the Marines, they want you to feel that way, that you're part of this tradition that goes back to Guadalcanal and goes back even further than that, and they'll tell you, from the halls of Montezuma. They just go through all the things that they've done before, so you feel like you're part of this tradition and that you're willing to sacrifice yourself for that tradition. Right? And that's why you have the ads again during the Packer game. God, it was cold. You have the young men out in nature. Why don't they have the young women out there yet? The advertisements still don't have the women doing it, even though the women are doing it, right? The advertisements don't have the women doing it. Interesting, right? But, okay, you're doing the rock climbing, you're in Utah, you've broken all the rules of the state park, and you're going up that hill, okay? And when you get up the top, boom, the sword, right? It's still a sword. It's not an automatic weapon, it's a sword, right? Medieval. You're connected with that tradition. Right? And you'll be willing to sacrifice yourselves as the Marines did at Tarawa and at Iwo Jima and everyone else, everywhere else. And you're part of this glorious line of people who have sacrificed yourself. Well, here are the origins of that. Right? The French had it, but they had it in different terms. It's the Germans that incorporated it in German militarism and military culture. Well, for 13-year-old boys and Marines, it's kind of cool. Right, so that gets pulled over into other military cultures, and it's become a part of it ever since. Now, the other images that I have here are images at the same time that Caspar David Friedrich is painting that. This is what's going on, right? These big battles. Right? This is sort of a reminder. These big paintings of the great battles of the Revolutionary period. So Romanticism and Revolutionary grow up together at the same time. Okay. Now,